Amen. Building the temple. So when we get to the Second Chronicles, the temple, Solomon's temple, is talked about in several different, if you read the Old Testament, you'll notice that First and Second, you got First and Second Samuel and First and Second Kings and First and Second Chronicles. You start reliving some of the things. You get through First and Second Kings, you think, well, okay, I got a pretty good idea of what the kings went through. And then you get into Chronicles, and it's a lot of the same stories. It's just additions to it. So as we read about the temple, we're going to take the version out of Second Chronicles in this lesson. And it's going to talk about Solomon and where he chose to place this building. Apparently, he didn't choose it himself. This is something that God had intended for a long time earlier. And one of the stories we are familiar with, another one I was not as familiar with, that when I study, I realized that, you know, there was a purpose for it as well. So in verse 1 of chapter 3 of 2 Chronicles, it says, "Then Solomon, in the fourth year of his reign, and then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah." First and Second Kings didn't tell us that. First and Second Chronicles does. "In Mount Moriah, where the Lord appeared unto David his father, in the place that David had prepared in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite." Remember, Jebusites were the ones who lived in Jerusalem prior to David. David comes and conquers, and he didn't kill everybody. There were still people there that were Jebusites. So we know about Mount Moriah because we heard that from the early Old Testament, the book of Genesis, where Abraham is sojourning and following God's direction, and God has given him a promise of a seed that he's going to multiply to the sand, to the size of the sand of the sea, and he's going to come through Isaac. And we know that he appears unto Abraham one night and tells him that he wants Abraham to gather the young man, the young boy that is the promised seed, Isaac, and I want you to take him to a place where I will show you, to the land of Moriah, and there I want you to sacrifice him to me. Now, of course, Abraham, this shows you his absolute faith. Abraham, you're thinking, all right, this makes no sense at all. He's the promised son that has been promised by God, and the same God is now telling me to kill him, sacrifice him, to the Lord. And so he wakes up the next morning, he tells his son to get ready, and he gets a couple of his helpers, a couple of men that will help them travel, and they start walking to the land of Moriah. Now, the land of Moriah is made up of several hills outside of what would be known as the city of Jerusalem. We don't know if the city was established during Abraham's day or not. We know that Melchizedek, the priest that we know so little about, was the king of Salem, so we think that there was some type of a historical biblical city there in the same footprints of Jerusalem called Salem, where Melchizedek was king of. But Moriah was somewhere around the area at that time and had several hillsides, and it is understood through Scripture that where Solomon is instructed to build this temple is going to be on the same hillside, or the same mountainside, as where Abraham went to sacrifice his son Isaac. When Isaac carried the wood on his back, just like Jesus would do thousands of years later, up the hill to be his own son, to lay his own life down, Isaac not knowing it, of course, that was where this temple will be incorporated in. The actual temple itself, which we'll learn is not a huge building, could very well be right over the place where Abraham laid Isaac on the altar to slay him thousands of years earlier. But then it also says that it's where the Lord appeared unto David his father, in a place that David had prepared, in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, the threshing floor where they actually build a structure and they can press thresh out the wheat and everything, and the wheat falls through the floor and the chaff blows in the wind away, so what's left on the bottom is the actual wheat from the chaff. Apparently, if we study what this is talking about, you remember when David was in warfare and God told him to not do one thing. I'm going to lead this. I'm going to be I'm going to be your, you may have Joab as your general, but I'm going to lead the nation of Israel in warfare, and I'm going to, you know, fight your battles for you. And the one thing I don't want you to do, David, is I don't want you to number the people. I don't want you to do a census count. I don't want numbers to come out as how many is out there, because I want all the glory. I don't want any type of numerical advantages and things like this, for whatever the reason that God gave for not numbering the people. And for the longest time, David would not. But there came a time when David made a decision that he was going to number the people and disobey God. And even his general, Joab, came to him and says, we can't do this. You've already told me that God told you not to do this. And David ignored Joab, reminding him that this was something that God didn't want. And he numbered the people, and the Bible even tells us the numbers that that they counted and accumulated. It also tells us that God was very upset and displeased with the sin of David, disobeying him, to the point where he sent the death angel. We don't know if it's the same death angel that went through Egypt or whatever, but he sent the angel of death through the encampments round about Israel, the land of Israel, and had, with this plague of death, killed 70,000 Israelite people. 70,000 people died as a result of David's sin of disobedience. And it got so bad that the Bible listed as a plague, and you could almost see, apparently, if you read the story, that they can tell the plague's getting closer and closer to Jerusalem, the capital city. And as it got right on the doorsteps of Jerusalem, as the plague was, you saw more and more people dying as it gets closer to Jerusalem, that David finally repents to the Lord and asks him to forgive him, acknowledges that I have sinned against you by numbering the people. All of these deaths are on me. They are because of me, and I repent. And God told him to build an altar at a location, and the location was right where the plague had stopped and was getting ready to enter into the city of Jerusalem, right on the outskirts there, at a place called Ornan's threshing floor, his home place, his place where he lived. So David went there to this threshing floor and built an altar and sacrificed unto the Lord to stop the plague and the wrath of God at that location. And apparently God had told David that this is where my permanent house will be as well. So you've got Mount Moriah, where Abraham sacrifices his son. We believe thousands of years later, a man named Ornan, who's living in that same area, has a threshing floor, and David goes and builds an altar. And all of those two things together is where this temple is going to be located. And this is where Solomon is instructed to build. So we get the background history and the symbolic nature of both of those stories to where he's building it now. And it says, and he began to build in the second day of the second month in the fourth year of his reign. So he's been on the throne for 4 years when he begins. We also know that he has started collecting materials. He's made treaties with foreign kings to get the wood that's going to be needed. Jerusalem, apparently, I've never been there, but apparently there's not a lot of forest out in Israel. But they would get their wood from Lebanon through cedar trees and fir trees. And he had made treaties with the king there that let's form a pact. If you give me this wood, then I'll provide the food. We've got plenty of growing area, so we can provide you food for your people if you supply us with the wood that I'm going to need to build this great temple. And they agree to that. So in verse 3, now these are the things wherein Solomon was instructed for the building of the house of God. He gives us the dimensions, the length by cubits, which apparently is about 18 inches a cubit. After the first measure was 80 cubits and the breadth 20 cubits. And he made the most holy house, which is the temple itself, the length whereof was according to the breadth of the house 20 cubits, and the breadth thereof 20 cubits, and he overlaid it with fine gold amounting to 600 talents. Now, several scriptures were skipped. If we would go back and read 4 through 7, it would give us more dimensions and things like this. When you break down the great temple of Solomon, the temple itself was not that big. When you look at just the actual dimensions given for the portion, what they call the holy place, where the priest would go in, where you had the tables of showbread, you had the candlesticks, where, you know, it was, they were always had to be lit, the candles always had to be burning, and you had the showbread there that was replaced every 7 days. That place where only the priest could go, and then you had the Holy of Holies. The whole temple, Solomon's temple, was only about 30 feet wide and about 90 feet long. You could almost put it inside the church. You could put it inside the church if you go from, I don't know if 90 feet from one wall to the other. But it's a small place when you think of an incredible Solomon's temple. You think that this has to be just an enormous place for all that he's going to go through with the laborers that he's going to hire and the materials he's going to gather and the stone that's going to be accumulated and brought to the site. But the actual temple where no one could go is only about 30 by 90. But inside of this, which is going to be made of wood, cedar wood and fir wood, which was selected by Solomon because it does not rot. It does not have rot, it does not rot at all. But as he would build this temple, he would overlay everything with fine gold. The structure itself was made of wool, but wood, and the outside was not gold, but the inside was in completely gold. The ceilings were gold, the floor was gold, the walls were decorated gold. They had all kind of, he had decorations of palm trees and flowers and cherubims that were engraved into the walls. And of course, the Holy of Holies was 30 square. It was 30 deep and 30 wide. So the rest was 30 by 60. So it's not a very big building, but we're only talking about the priest that could go in there. But it's outside of the temple that we see that this monumental building plot. Kathy, it's probably a good time if you'll throw that on there. Hopefully you can see this. This is an idea of Solomon's temple. There's going to wind up being three temples on this site. This is the first one. This is Solomon's temple that we're talking about. You'll see the large, the tall building in the very middle is the actual temple of God that's got gold on everything and inside. The temple itself is 45 feet tall. It's very, very tall. And, you know, if you go in, only the priest would go in. And if you go outside that front door, you'll see that, you can't see very good, but this is symbolic. You see the smaller wall around the temple itself is kind of symbolic of the tabernacle tent that we talked about several months ago. This is where people could go inside that smaller wall and give sacrifices to the Lord. That's where the big brazen altar was and that inner court where, you know, the big basin and the big fire, and the priest would have to walk up and he would have to offer all the bulls and everything. It's a huge altar there. And then the brazen, the basin full of water where you could cleanse yourself. And if you were a male and you wanted to worship God, you could go into that inner court and sacrifice and give worship. But outside that inner court, where you see the large outer court, this is all part of what they call the Temple Mount. There's towers on the right-hand side. This is where the Levites would live that were obviously working through the temple in their time. There were rooms and chambers and upper chambers and places all around the outside of this thing. And there was only one or two places that you could go into this inner court. You had to enter at certain gates. And the gates would lead out to the hillsides out beside the city. So this is on the outskirts of Jerusalem. This is not in the middle of Jerusalem back in then. This is on the outskirts of Jerusalem. And this was Solomon's temple. Now later on, this would be destroyed by the Babylonians. And later, when the Babylonian king, or the Persians, would conquer Babylon, and Cyrus would allow certain Jews to go back and rebuild. Remember when Zerubbabel would go back and he would build the temple, it would be a larger courtyard that he would build. And then when Jesus would come on the scene, Herod got involved in it. Herod was also arrogant. Everything he wanted was to show himself. So he expanded this thing almost twice as big as what we have here. Not the temple itself, but the courtyards. So when we talk about this thing taking 7 years to build, it's not necessarily the temple itself, but it's the whole massive temple mount that we see. And this is why when you read in the Old Testament and even the New Testament, where you have, you know, when Peter goes out and he witnesses and says the Spirit has fallen, and he goes out and he's preaching and 3,000 souls are saved, these temple mounts can hold tens of thousands of people by the time Jesus is coming on the earth. So it's easy for thousands of people to be gathered into the temple mount. But the actual temple of Solomon, the one that's got fully gold and the Holy of Holies, is quite small. All right, so let's go on to 2 Chronicles chapter 4, verse 19. It said, "And Solomon made all the vessels that were used for the house of God, the golden altar also, which is right before the Holy of Holies, and the tables whereupon the showbread was set. He made all of these as pure gold." Pure gold. Everything that David had been collecting, Solomon continued to collect, pure gold and silver. Everything in it was gold. In chapter 5, it says, "Thus all the work that Solomon made for the house of the Lord was finished." After 7 years, he's built this incredible temple mount. "And Solomon brought in all the things that David his father had dedicated, the silver and the gold and all the instruments. He put them among the treasures in the house of God. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel, unto Jerusalem." He's bringing them in from the countryside, from Israel, the land that flowed with milk and honey, where all the tribes had been dispersed. He's calling out for the elders of those tribes and the fathers of those people to come to Jerusalem for this dedication, and to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. Now, what he is referring to, he's built the Temple Mount, but the Ark of the Covenant is still sitting down the street there somewhere else in Jerusalem, where the palace is, where David, his father, had established a tent for the Ark to be. So they're going to now that the temple of God is being constructed, he is bringing all the heads of state in. He's going to bring all the elders in, and they're going to watch the Ark of the Covenant move from where David had placed it into its final place here, the place that God had established, into the temple, into the Holy of Holies. In this Holy of Holies, something that was different than the tabernacle, Solomon was instructed to build two large cherubims. Cherubims here had wings. They had faces of a human, but they had lion type of features. They were to be 15 feet tall, standing facing the veil, behind the veil, but facing the veil, protecting, so to speak, not that it didn't need protection, but it was standing almost guard where the Ark of the Covenant would be seated right in front, or right between the two large 15-foot cherubims. 15 feet would probably be, I'm assuming, higher than the chandeliers here, slightly higher. So they're standing there in the temple, and the Ark of the Covenant's about the size, almost about the size of the speaker, maybe a little longer, but it's not very big. So you can imagine these massive things, all gold, everything's gold. So they're bringing in the Ark of the Covenant. And it says, "And the priest brought in the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord unto his place, to the oracle of the house, into the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubims," which is what he had built. Skipping down, and it says, "And it came to pass, as the trumpeters and the singers were as one." He wanted this to be, remember who we're talking about, this is Solomon. Solomon is outward appearance. Solomon is extravagant. I'm gonna make this an extravagant situation. We're going to talk about the dedication next week, but we can almost get a foretaste of it here, where he is telling the elders that we are going to really bring in this ark. We're going to have trumpeters. We're going to have singers. We're going to have all kind of unified worship going on. "So as they were one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking the Lord, and when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets, the cymbals, and instruments of music, and praised the Lord while they were praising the Lord." It wasn't just the Ark of the Covenant being removed from one location to the other, but the key that Solomon says is, while we're doing it, while the symbol of God is coming, we're going to be worshiping. We're not just going to sit back and watch this parade. We're not going to take pictures and say, "Yeah, there's the Ark of the Covenant we've heard." Remember, when they would move it from one place to the other, they would cover that ark. You couldn't just see the Ark of the Covenant. They would cover it where you couldn't see it, And while it went from one location to another, he's got praise singers. He's got the people praising the Lord. They're worshiping God. You can imagine, as wherever it's coming from, people from all over doing one thing in one accord, they're worshiping God. That's all that's focused, that's all that they're focusing on, is focusing on the Lord himself as the Ark of the Covenant is being removed to its final location. And it says, as they lifted up their voices and praised the Lord, saying, and this is what they were singing, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. Those were what they were. They were praising the Lord. Praising the Lord, for he is good, and his mercy endureth forever, that then the house, the temple, not the whole temple mount, but the temple, was filled with a cloud, even the house of the Lord, so much so that the priest could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud. We don't know to what extent. Was the power? Was the visibility? Was it the awesome presence that they couldn't even stand up to do what they were there to do? For the glory of the Lord had filled the house of God. For all these years, 400 years, the glory of the Lord would go to the tabernacle. We don't know how long it had been since the glory of the Lord had filled the tabernacle once David removed the Ark of the Covenant and took it to Jerusalem. People still went to Gibeon and worshiped in the tabernacle. They still sacrificed out there, but we don't know how long it had been since the glory of the Lord had been seen, felt, shown there in the tabernacle. But we know now that the temple has been built. It's starting the dedication. And as it's being moved from one location, the ark is moving into the house. The worship of God moved God. The worship and praise of God was what the key was that made God's presence come into the house. Now, we could spend some time there, couldn't we? The worship in the house, the worship around the house, the worship of the congregation is what brought God's glory and his presence into the house. And he established his presence there in the Holy of Holies, so much so that it filled the entire temple, even the holy place where the priests were trying to get prepared to minister. They couldn't even stand. When we look at, and when we study this, is mind-blowing. It talks about how Solomon hired 30,000 men to help build this temple mount. It says the temple, but I'm assuming it was for the whole temple mount. He had 80,000 workers who were in the mountains of Lebanon and Israel carving out stones. It said that he wanted to a point where you couldn't bring the stones to the temple mount and carve it there. You had to carve it to its proper measurements outside the city because he didn't want the sound of workers and beating and banging and all that there. We don't know why. That was Solomon. So when they brought the stones to the location, it was already cut precisely to fit in its place. But it took 80,000 workers to do the cutting, the gathering, the transporting, the laying, all of this. And it took them 7 years to do it, to build what you see there. All for the name of the Lord. All for God to have a place to dwell. Solomon certainly wanted it to be a show place. He certainly wanted it to give the proper reverence. As we, even today, thousands of years later, we want our places to be places of worship for reverence. We want them to look nice. We want God's presence to be here, and we learn from this on what brings God's presence to our building. This is just a building. When we leave, we don't lock God up in here. He's not sitting here for 6 days waiting for us to come back or whatever. He comes in when we're here because we are the church, and we come in, and with our worship, he comes and fills the house. With what Solomon did, he was basically, this had been pre-planned, preordained for thousands of years, all the way back to Abraham. It just shows us once again how God is timeless. He knew from the Garden of Eden, the experience when man first fell, everything that he was going to do. And time is it's important to God, but it's not like time is to us. He knew what timing was going to be, and he needed 2,000 years, I think, from Adam to Abraham. And Abraham would build an altar, and that would be symbolic of where the temple would be. And, you know, at that point, we realize that God is certainly a God of planning and a God of symbology. He wanted his word to point back consistently to other events from Genesis to Revelation. That's why the Old Testament and the New Testament have to go together, because as you read the whole Bible, it continually points back and confirms what he did earlier was symbolic of what he would do later. The temple is no different. You know, the temple would be, like I said, it would be destroyed by the Babylonians, be rebuilt by Zerubbabel, who would then, it would be destroyed in 70 AD after it was completely enlarged by Herod, by the Romans themselves. And this temple mount that you see, is no more. When it was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans, they never rebuilt it, but they want to. I believe there's a wall, and I'll leave you with this. I believe the front door of the temple was facing east. It always wanted to face east, just like the tabernacle. So I've never been to Jerusalem, but they say there's the Wailing Wall, and I think it's the Western Wall, and that would put it on the back side of the temple back there into the city itself, where I think portions of that still remain, where if you go there, they still practice their weeping and wailing at the wall and putting in their prayers into the cracks of the wall that's been there for thousands of years. Their hope is to rebuild their temple. We long for it because it's a sign of the times that we're out of here. They long for it so that they can begin practicing their sacrifices and things of this nature that are no longer necessary. But we study the temple because it shows God's providence, it shows God's promises, and it points to the fact that Christ would come and provide that ultimate sacrifice, that ultimate blood that was shed, that would take the place of this temple, where now the temple is right here. It's in each of us. When we receive Christ, your heart becomes the temple of the Lord. The Bible tells us the temple of the Holy Ghost. But the temple of the Lord is in us now. We gather in our buildings, but our heart is the temple that God wanted us to build for him. And when we open up in praise, he comes into our temple.